Hello, this is Cameron McEwen and Bob Dobbs with our first session for 2023. This will be episode number 63, and we're recording on January 19th, 2023. So I haven't talked to Cameron in 3 or 4 weeks or something. We did our last show December 22nd, so at least 3 weeks. But I sent him a notice which he wants me to talk a bit about. So let me bring that up. Okay, there it is. So we were on the radio. Let's see, we started in January the 10th, 1724, what is this? So 17th, it was, yeah. So on January 10th, we were doing our short show on a Tuesday. And Ian announced, he had told me privately, but I didn't know if we were going to talk about it. Usually I let Ian decide what's going to be said. Sometimes he tells me, you don't say anything about this, so I think he's not going to say anything. But then he does during the public show. He'll go into it a bit. So he announced that we now have, or Bob now has 5 nuclear reactors. Now, what's that mean? We got our first one about a year ago. Now, as we developed what popularly is known as cold fusion, or in the other end, the big ones called hot fusion. And they announced a month or so ago, hot fusion guys, that they hope to have something useful in a year or so. Now, Ion says that hot fusion big contraption, all they're getting is and trying to get is excess heat. What we've gotten with our one or two, I'll just call them boxes, we get endless electricity. We've had that for 10 years, and we've tried to interest people, the Obama government and Hillary Clinton and them, but they weren't interested. But Trump was, for some reason, partly because he's on our product, so that might have made, he got some people to listen to our show, and then he heard about this, so he met with JW, the guy that Ion comes through. It doesn't have to come through, but generally for public consumption comes through JW. So they became friends over the last 4 years or so. And so when this led to some meetings with the Department of Homeland Security and some other people in other levels of intelligence, we didn't even know who they were, they would request to meet with JW because he was in Atlanta and they could get to him easily. So that happened. And one of the statements, one of the guys said a couple months ago, well, you guys are quite a pair. You come out of nowhere and take over the world. Okay. So that's what this guy said. He knew what we had. That was pretty amazing. See, we have a box that can make endless electricity. That's way better than excess heat. So they're working with big stuff in the hot fusion zone, but we've got a small thing, and it's more powerful or more potent. And it's partly because Ion told us how to make it. So it's coming from non-physical, which is what Ion calls itself. So this is a new kind of science to work with non-physical, whatever that is, and it guides us in making things. JW is pretty handy. He's got a lot of money, so he was able to buy the materials to make the thing 10 years ago. So we've had it working. Now, as we developed it over the last 10 years, it gave off other energy, so to speak. So it caused a few earthquakes here and there and some other strange phenomena. So when we'll call them the government, the more inside secret government, realized we had something, they knew that we didn't know what would happen as we used it, because it's never been around before. So out of the blue, a year ago, we were given a nuclear reactor, one of those big fortresses, and we were allowed to tinker with it, play with it, implement it, use it, because if it blew up, it would blow up inside the nuclear reactor structure. See what I mean? It would keep whatever effects happened within the building rather than affecting the countryside around, so or even atmosphere. So that's why we were given a nuclear reactor a year ago. And so we've used it and developed whatever, fine-tune it. It's now ready to go publicly when the grid collapses and the government needs something. But meanwhile, I had announced that, he just told me the day before, that we got four more. So we have five nuclear reactors in different parts of the United States that are going to be used to do things, I'll just say. Even make things. But I have to be careful. I'm not supposed to say too much about it. So that's what we announced. So I typed this up and put it on my Facebook page and sent it to you and a few other people. I said, ION just announced that IONDOM, as we call our scene as IONDOM, now has five nuclear reactors for our coal play, which is our term for what we have as opposed to coal fusion, which was made by Pons and Fleischmann in 1989. So in brackets, endless electricity. We got our first one a year ago. I've been sitting on that fact until the appropriate timing. And then I say, nuclear reactors, exclamation point. Our coal play is so powerful that we had to test it inside a nuclear reactor in case it blew up. The reactor would contain the explosion if it happened. But we got it under control now. And I say, can you comprehend this? Who gave them to us? And then I said, Elon Musk is going to have to move aside. Elon Musk is going to have to move aside as we offer the new ground, the new technology. So that's what's happening. You can ask me anything about it that you think about. What, do you have any questions, or did I explain it in good detail?
No, you explained it fine. When you're talking about nuclear reactors, I presume you're talking about nuclear reactors that are no longer active.
That's right. I don't think there are any active in the States. I think there's 170 of them. Let me just – I checked that a couple of months ago. Let me just see.
No, there's lots of nuclear reactors that are still active, but there's also lots that aren't.
Okay, let me just see. So I'm saying how many nuclear reactors in the USA? 92. Across the United States, 92 nuclear reactors power tens of millions of homes and anchor local communities. So how many U.S. states have nuclear reactors? 55 locations in 28 states. The majority of nuclear reactors are in the eastern portion of the United States. I know where one is. I don't know where the other four are. Ian has not told me. So we're not sure who gave permission for us to enter one a year ago. Or JW hasn't told me. He may know, but he does say it's strange. We have our suspicions, but my point is that that's how confident somebody is in what we have, and they're giving us the proper environment for it to develop it. So that's the really good news. We got the recognition we couldn't get from Obama's administration, and I would attribute that to Trump. We don't seem to have much interaction with the Biden cabinet. Well, nobody does, eh? What is Biden? We don't even know what he is. But we are involved with the more secretive parts of, I guess you call it, national security. They're the ones, and they don't change with administrations too much. So the permanent government, it's called continuity of government. The permanent government is who I think is sponsoring us. So that's the big news, and we're on our way. It's I don't think anything's going to stop us unless there's some nuts that are really pissed off who are investing in other technology and are going to try to sabotage us in some ways. Mm-hmm. But we really have pretty good protection.
But so, essentially, this is the ground is new science.
Yes,
that's right. The box itself is an effect of the new science, right?
Yep, and it's spiritual, biblical. It's something because, I mean, I will show us quotes in the Bible where it talks about us. The famous Ezekiel wheel within a wheel is a reference to this device. So the device comes from wherever ion's from. And so Ion says that regular science cannot create any new stuff now. They have to work with non-physical or with ion, whatever that is. So we're the first to do that. So it's a whole new kind of science. And I like to read McLuhan and LaRouche to see if they are on to that. Do you know what I mean? Do they recognize sure. there's a new science afoot, a new effect, so to speak? I think mm-hmm. McLuhan was hinting at it. Maybe we can find quotes.
He was more than hinting at it. McLuhan talked about new science in those words.
Yes.
A lot in the 1970s. His writings and lectures on it from that time are preserved in the Global Village and in Laws of Media. So in those two posthumous books, he speaks over and over again about new science and contrasts it to old science.
And he does mention in terms of devices or efficient causality, in War and Peace, he talks about the natural development of anti-gravity devices due to being now living in tactile space. So we're not subject to visual space gravity. So he predicted that. He said, I never heard it, but he and Eric did a series on CBC around 1970 on pyramids, and that was like acoustic space or something, or maybe tactile space. Did you ever hear of that, that radio series they did?
No, but I remember talking to Eric one day on the phone about his interest in Egypt. He wrote a book on Egypt that's not published, and he dedicated a lot of his time to Egypt.
Yeah, he had a theory. He told me in his art class in 78 at the Anterior College of Art and Design, I guess it is, that the hieroglyphics on Egyptian artifacts is you see the profile of the person and some other factors. And he says it means they're spinning. Remember him telling you that? The image
yeah, sure.
is spinning. And yeah. so there's motion. The way they're drawn, it is indicate motion. So they're like cartoons.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He found great significance in that. But
yeah.
if you look at
his... that's sort of a literalism, right? I mean, behind that idea is that there's another kind of visuality
yes.
at play. And I think this other kind of visuality points to new science away from old science.
Yeah, I call it the tactile eye.
Yeah, that would work.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Now, you see, hear that noise. Is that coming from you or me?
No. I don't hear a noise.
Okay. It's on my end. All right. So hopefully it's not too bad. So the other thing is in books, in Eric's 1998-99 book, The Electric Language, he talks about ESP. He extends what his father said in a sentence or two. Do you remember those sentences in that book?
No. Eric gave me the book, and I read it, but it's been 20 years.
Right. Well, he says the anti-gravity and other, you know, strange new kinds of Newtonian technologies are naturally going to come forth. And he also says parts of the brain will be extended by computer. Like you have the general mm-hmm. central nervous system extended by television and electricity,
right.
say. But the particulars in the brain may be digital apps that come from some parts of the brain functions. So I remember mm-hmm. him saying that in there. Anyways,
yeah.
they were thinking about this stuff, and so they'd be interested in and wouldn't be puzzled by what I'm talking about, I don't think. As a matter of fact, you know, basically, like he says, Eric describes television as a certain way in the electric environment, and naturally you're going to get new effects that aren't part of visual space. Are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. That aren't part of visual space. So they're predicting that science will have different models, have to have different concepts, different models as it probes the new effects. And to me, that's what ION is about. And so it's very appropriate that I stumble in and evoke ION accidentally, since I was McLuhan's archivist. You know, naturally I picked up on that, eh? I continue Marshall's work with ION.
Well, his I think that's McLuhan's deepest intention, is to have people continue the work.
Yeah.
Because to continue the work is a realization of communication. And what McLuhan was talking about from very early times, you know, from in the 1930s already, was the deep reality of communication. That's what Logos is.
Do you think his father was into that, being into Rosicrucianism, and that might have sparked that kind of thinking?
Maybe, but was that his, I think it was his mother that...
No, his father was. He used to have a pretty interesting conversation with his father. I read that somewhere. Yes, mother too, but I think his father might have been more speculative, where she was more active.
Oh, I agree with what you're saying there.
Yeah.
I was just remarking on the specifics of an interest in Rosicrucianism.
Yeah.
If the mother took that up later, I think when she was in Detroit, so this was in the late 1930s and early 1940s. That's his conversations with his father were more in around 1930 when they were both still in Winnipeg.
Right, but his father might have been talking his strange ideas.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was an Irishman, right? He had he had an interest in all sorts of stuff that was outside the norm.
That's right. So McLuhan, you know, he was in a free-ranging intellectual environment there with his parents. You know, so
yeah, relative to Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, not free-ranging relative to the world. It took him 20 or 30 years to...
Yeah, to catch up.
That's right, to what was going on in the wider universe, you could say.
Yes. So... that's that. Well, I just explained to you, and people listening can ask me about it. I can't say much more than what I said. I said as much. But what's interesting for general consumption is that I'm proposing that this is a new way to do science with this other source that helps you, that guides you. It's what I like to say is that ION is a new technology which talks about itself and its effects. And we do discuss the effects of what we're going to do. I mean, we're not just cluedly saying, oh, well, let's put this out there and, you know, destroy the economy and everything. People lose jobs. We're very careful on what this means to society. Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
Well, there's an interesting dialectic here. In that any kind of device is dependent upon a science that is deeper than it. But then the device creates a new environment which then allows the deeper science to be perceived.
Is the deeper science the concepts that comes to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, just if you think about chemistry 200 years ago.
Okay, right, that's what we were going to go into, so this will be appropriate. So you sent me an email. Let's see if I can find it here. I can read it.
I think it was January the 4th, was that?
Yeah, January the 4th, date received. Okay, here it is. You say, you sent me an email on January 4th. Tactile space is the medium that is the message. And then you sent me a new thing you've written called Three Types of Space, a new blog. And you say, does this post, and I read it, but your question is, does this post remind you of our attempt at communication at Mark Stallman's place more than 30 years ago? That was in 1998. And I said, I don't remember. And you started to say to me your answer. And so I said, well, let's record this. So it's, you can, the electrical, the chemical elements is where you started. So what happened? What did you tell us back in? I asked you what got you into McLuhan or something, right? What sparked your interest?
That's right. That's right. And so then I began to describe what I took to be the spectrum of experiential elements. And I think at that point you decided that I was too conceptual or too something or other.
No, that was later. In 99, 2000, when we were on Peter, Peter's, whatever his name was, Peter's thing.
But I don't know.
I don't recall you saying anything. I don't think I understood it, what you were saying. It's totally blank. But, and I didn't even know you were saying that, in your post in 99, 2000 on that McLuhan list. But when we started talking in 2015 or so, or maybe a little earlier, we did a series. That's when you told me what you're going to say now. And it's the first time I heard it. So, but go ahead. You were saying, yeah, it sounded conceptual, but show me how it isn't conceptual or whatever it is that it is. So what's the idea about chemistry?
What I tried to do in this post is talk about what tactile space is, as opposed to visual space or audible space.
Right.
And the reason that I thought that this might be interesting in terms of our conversations starting over 20 years ago,
yeah,
is that in the last time we spoke, you asked me about the medium between us. And I said, yeah, it's the medium of dialogue and of tactile space. And you said something like, no, I was talking about the telephone.
Yeah.
And so my response to that is this post where I try to show that tactile space is like new science. It's not like a device, like a telephone.
Right. I wanted to say that, fully aware of what you're saying, and I agree, because electricity is tactile, and we're not sure what it is, and everything that's been made the last 150 years is strange. And so to emphasize tactility is the most important thing about the electric environment, not the acoustic or the visual. So if you're saying that, then I agree. I do, half of tactility is object, the other half is not object, because it's an interplay of different factors. So I was just saying telephone, but I didn't mean that was the whole thing. That's not all of tactile space. It's a part of tactile space. You got to have that technology. You know what I mean?
Yes. It's the tactile space is an environment. And
right.
Within an environment, things become possible that weren't possible before.
Yeah.
Right? So as we were just saying a few minutes ago, the dialectic between how an environment gets established, what then becomes possible in that environment, and what those things in the environment then enable people to see and to sort of activate within a society. That's a very, very interesting topic, and one that is not possible within the confines of old science.
Yeah.
The very conversation about this takes place in new science.
So use your example of chemistry. You may have mentioned it in earlier talks, but just to set that up and then say what it, this new space, how it's different from chemistry, or it's the same approach that chemistry evoked, but there is something different. So we're going to get into what's different.
Yeah. Okay. But let's just start with the fact that in 1800, let's say, the environment of chemistry was fully active. It had always been active, and it always would be active, but nobody could see it. It was invisible. So you had an environment that was determining everything in our bodies and in the world around us and in the cosmos to its furthest reaches, but nobody knew about it. It was invisible.
Hmm.
So, and it was invisible, according to McLuhan, precisely because it was the environment. So according to McLuhan, environments per se are invisible. But what happens in history is that events can evoke an environment. They take place on the basis of the environment, but they somehow evoke it. And that's what happened with chemistry. People began to delimit the chemical elements, and that illuminated the environment that was already there.
Right. Well, right, what's so the first action? Is it Lavoisier? Who's the person that sort of gets the credit?
Lavoisier and Priestley.
Okay.
So, Lavoisier is the – Priestley still was very much involved with old science and phlogiston. But
yeah.
So Lavoisier was the guy that began to figure out that it was possible to define atoms or elements that had been talked about since the Greeks. So for over 2,000 years, but nobody had been able to isolate how talk about atoms and elements could be communicated. Because if you just have talk, then you have alchemy. Anybody can say, well, this is an element or that is an element, but they're unable to communicate that in a deep way that allows other people to do the same experiments and to come to the same results, and on the basis of those results, to advance further.
So okay, what now that came in with the alphabet. What experiments did they do, 2,500 years ago? Static electricity stuff?
Well, they weren't really doing experiments.
What did they do? They just talked about the idea, which was the effect of the alphabet, I guess, that there's these particulars.
This is a very good question, and people have looked into it a lot. For example, Heidegger, as he got later in his career, became more and more involved with the pre-Socratics. And in Heidegger's analysis, which is somewhat parallel to McLuhan's, with the development of philosophy and the economy and everything that became possible sort of through classical Greece, you not only had great efficiencies and great advances in various fields, but you also had loss. So according to McLuhan, and I think this is also true of Heidegger, before 400 in Greece with the pre-Socratics, you have a kind of window onto a premonition, you could say, of new science that was lost in the development of old science, right? So in this sense, the new came before the old.
Would that be Plato versus Aristotle?
No. Well, first, any kind of, Plato was this and Aristotle was that and their relation was this, is not very good. In sort of, you could say in the popular conception, Plato is sort of an airy-fairy abstract guy, and Aristotle is more of a practical guy.
He was a chartered accountant.
Okay, yeah. But it's, all of that is nonsense. Both Plato and Aristotle are far deeper and far wiser than anybody today. And one way to think about the attempt to get into new science is the attempt to recover what those guys knew. They were sort of people with one foot in the pre-literate environment and one foot in the post-literate environment. And so they were, in an intellectual realm, they were a little bit like Shakespeare in an aesthetic realm,
yeah,
where the Elizabethans had still one foot firmly planted in the pre-literate and one foot in the literate. And in that divide, they were able to produce these great plays.
Yeah.
So something like that is also true of Plato and Aristotle. So when Havelock, let's say, in preface to Plato, is talking about the great change that takes place into a literate environment, while that's true, it's also true that there's a great deal in Plato that recalls the pre-Socratics. Mm. And Havelock himself was very aware of this. You had asked me about what was before Plato, and I'm trying to say that there was an intuition of new science that became lost. And we had talked about pre-tribal awareness.
Yep.
So this pre-tribal awareness was a factor in the development of the literate environment, but it was a factor as a unknown cause. Whereas before the literate environment, with the pre-Socratics, there is a sense of pre-tribal awareness that is what we need to recover today.
Right. So as they got into Aristotle and then the Hellenic period, they're getting bogged down in visual space. It's the eye is starting to dominate, so they lose the flexibility, tactility of the Plato and pre-Plato or the pre-Socratics, who are half literate and half pre-literate, right? That's what's going on. It's more balanced back there.
Yeah, but remember, in all of this, there isn't, good versus bad, a decline versus an advance and all this sort of stuff. There's always both. So what takes place in Greece starting around 400 BC has been the decisive influence on all of Western civilization. So many of our words go back to the Greek at that time, and so do many of our institutions and our very way of looking at the world. So what took place 2,500 years ago, on the one hand, was a tremendous advance in insight. Modern science, humanities, medicine, all of these things only became possible through that. And to that extent, it was a great advance. But no advance is made without a retreat.
Mm.
So the what happens in classical Greece, and what is particularly realized, let's say, in the 19th century, is that by taking a sharp focus And sharp focus is by definition literate. By taking a sharp focus, you can invent all sorts of things. So this is the discovery of discovery that Whitehead talked about. The sharp focus, however, when it enables all sorts of amazing things like new manufacturing techniques, new medical techniques, new discoveries, when sharp focus is used in these ways, it necessarily abstracts from other important things. And these other important things do not go away. They build up and build up and build up and create a crisis.
Yeah, did you say distracts? Not abstracts. Distracts.
Yes, well, both, yeah. But,
yeah. Distracts.
I accept that, yeah.
So yeah. Crisis builds up. Now, is chemistry, chemical elements 200 years ago, is that 1 foot in the literate and 1 foot in the electric?
Well, I would say, yeah. I mean, first off, the electric isn't something that's only new. Our awareness of the electric is new.
Yeah.
But the electric and the tactile were always active, are always active, and always will be active. Right? So there's a difference between an active environment and our knowledge of that environment. So when people were discovering the chemical elements, they were operating in new science and in tactile space, but they didn't know that.
Yeah. So what did they, did chemistry develop refined visual space, or they did something, they brought in kinetic space? What is it that chemistry and the elements are, is new?
Well, what happened beginning around 1800 and then coming to fruition with Mendeleev's table in 1869, what happens is that chemistry introduces a new way of looking at the environment. And that new way of looking at the environment produced all sorts of new manufacturing techniques, all sorts of new ways of conducting war, all sorts of new ways of communicating. So the telegraph in the 1830s gets developed through the sort of laboratory experience that chemistry grounded, right? Well, that chemistry revolutionized. The alchemists were very active in laboratories, but they did not produce a common focus within their work. That's what chemistry is. Chemistry is the refinement of alchemy so that different researchers have the same focus.
They get on the same page. Is that what you mean?
Correct. That's absolutely correct.
Well, so explain how that's done by the discovery of whatever Lavoisier discovered. What did he find?
Well, what Lavoisier did was he began to intuit that there was that there were ways of isolating elements. And I believe, I haven't looked into what Lavoisier was doing for decades, but I believe he was working with mercuric oxide.
Okay.
What he was doing was measuring what happens when mercuric oxide is heated, and when mercuric oxide is heated, then you get oxygen as one of the products. And so what Lavoisier did, somewhat in common with Priestley, was isolate how you can focus on oxygen in a laboratory setting. And that idea then gets applied to all sorts of other elements that had been known for some of them for thousands and thousands of years, like silver and gold and tin and iron. All of these are actually elements, but they hadn't been known as elements. So what chemistry does is it gives you a kind of handle on how to talk about these things that are already active in the environment.
Yeah, you know that sentence in War and Peace, in Medium is a Massage? When information is brushed against information, the results are startling and effective, something like that. So mm-hmm. chemistry started to brush information against information, new ways of substance, and then made new substances and then brushed them against other substances. Is that
correct.
Basically what happened?
Yes, universities got labs. They didn't have them before, at least labs that were structured with their own journals and with professors going back and forth between universities and having students and creating traditions within science. All of that took off around 1800, and it produced the modern world.
Right. So, now, who's a resistor of that? Mesmer and Paracelsus?
Yeah, well, I mean, Paracelsus is much earlier than that. Mesmer is a little bit earlier than that, I believe. You could say, I don't think that they are resistors of that, but they are people that exposed other things.
Right.
And
so
people
who's an old stodgy conservative, so to speak, in relation to Lavoisier? Is there any names?
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of names of people that were trying to point to a wider reality, right? So, I mean, in England, people like Wordsworth and Coleridge were already trying to say, well, wait a minute, we've got these cities that are exploding. But there's also nature, and we can't forget nature. So there were all sorts of people, Mary Shelley with her book Frankenstein.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of people who saw that there was something else or that there were problems.
Yeah.
And there were always people that were saying that we needed to be cautious with the idea that we're only advancing.
Yes. Yeah, and that became the hypnosis, the big word progress in the 19th century. And
correct.
So then you had the divide between the humanists and the engineers about how much to rein in the drive for progress, and nobody could stop the progress. I think of McLuhan writing about Lewis in 43, 44 about basically media extend our appetite. So the appetite for novelty just takes over in the 19th century. And McLuhan said there was more invention in the 19th century than the 20th century, or at least up to
correct.
His time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, the humanists were always fighting a rear guard, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, but the, there was not, how can I say, it was not as if what was going on in the actual environment as opposed to the perceived environment, what was actually going on in the wider environment of both progress and retrogression at the same time, that environment was sensed, but nobody was able to articulate it in a way that produced an understanding of what was actually going on.
Yeah.
People tried to do that. People like Spengler tried to investigate what could be called the widest possible environment. And so people like Spengler were very important at the University of Toronto in the middle of the 20th century.
Yes.
So Northrop Frye was interested in Spengler. McLuhan was interested in Spengler. Innes was interested in Spengler. And it wasn't the details of what Spengler was talking about. It was the idea that there is a wider environment to what is going on, a wider environment that's implicated in world wars and in the depression of the 1930s. And until we get a way of focusing that larger environment, these disasters are going to keep happening.
Would you say it's a wider effect?
Yeah, so the wars and depression are, economic depression, were taken to be effects of something that was not quite known.
Yeah.
Right? Now, so lots of people like Keynes put forward ideas of how these things happened. But as we can see today, nobody really knows what the hell's going on. In fact, we're more confused than ever.
And so the humanist side caught up in a way, though it took McLuhan to point it out, you know, Joyce, Eliot, Pound, and Lewis, and maybe Yeats, what they were seeing, the wider environment, may not, maybe McLuhan did come up with the best way to define it and lay it out, using them as examples, early canaries in the mind, in the collective mind, or collective mind, M-I-N-E. But would you agree with that, Spengler was on something, but those four guys, the four evangelists in Finnegan's Wake, were picking up something that Spengler missed in his field, so to speak. They were seeing things in his field that he didn't see.
Yeah, so at least in my view, McLuhan is the one guy that found a way to focus the environment that people like Pound and Eliot and Joyce and Yeats were working in, and that they sensed. But McLuhan was the guy that supplied the focus.
How about Joyce and them? They were the Lavoisier level, or times, and McLuhan was Mendeley's periodical chart level.
Yes, that's more or less my theory right there.
You have that? You said that?
Yeah, well, that's what I say over and over again in the blog.
Yeah, you say that in the three spaces thing that we started talking about. We'll look at a couple.
Well, but I've been talking about that in the blog in this blog and in a previous blog since at least 2000. I didn't have a blog before that, but
since we met, you had that in your mind in 98.
Oh, definitely, and I had been talking and writing about it since 1980 at least.
That's pretty good. But that was always in an academic context, right? And when you
well,
were in university?
Well, I mean, I was involved in business for most of those years in different ways. And I had the idea already in the 1970s that it might be easier within a business environment to talk about these ideas than an academic one. Something that McLuhan himself for many years.
Yeah. Did you bring these ideas up when you went to those seminars around Derrida, whatever you studied in Europe?
Well, I tried to, but the whole idea that there could be a new science of these kinds of ideas was just met with stony silence. So.
Okay. But you studied under Kuhn. Were you able to discuss it with him, Kuhn?
No, because I was too immature, number one. And number two, his interests were completely different from mine at that time.
Yeah.
I was greatly influenced by the guy because he was my advisor in my junior year, I had to read Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Yes.
Which that was in 1965, I think, he was my advisor. So the structure book was published by him in 1962.
Hmm.
So it was fairly recent at the time, and it wasn't yet a bestseller. You know, it became a book that sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies, but in those years, it only was selling hundreds of copies a year. People weren't influenced by it very much yet.
That's when you were at Princeton?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, you're going to say one more sentence?
Well, I was going to say I had to read that book in order to sort of talk to Kuhn, and that book is very much involved with our conversation now.
Yes.
Because when you ask me about chemistry, we're talking about a scientific revolution, and the whole question is, how does a scientific revolution come about, and what are its effects? And how that applies to all of our conversations is we're talking about new science.
Yeah.
And the question is, how does new science come about? And if it can come about, what will be its effects?
Right. Okay. So I don't know if you just, for people to get that with chemistry, you start to look at, is it visual space, substances, and putting it into a common page, a common chart? Is that, it was the organizing of the new substances that their experiments discovered? That's what you mean by chemical elements?
Yes, in part. Remember that when we look back to what was going on, let's say around 1800, we're doing a kind of history work. And history work always reflects a certain point of view or a certain environment, a certain context. So what you're talking about is a way of looking at that history that is itself visual.
Yes.
And that visual emphasis at the time that got multiplied throughout the course of the 19th century produced the modern world.
Yeah.
With all of its great advantages and all of its tremendous problems. But there are other ways of looking at that history. So we should, especially if we're trying to introduce new science, we need to be careful about the difference between a history and the history.
Yeah.
Right? When we're doing the history, we're within the confines of new science, and there things are always going up at the same time that they're going down. Things are always going backwards at the same time that they're going up. And so history, in that sense, is very much more complicated than just a linear movement towards organization.
Right. Okay, so I can immediately see that McLuhan looked at new information and its mixture, which he called media. So they were larger, it was a larger chemistry, a larger physics, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
So explain how, what's the revolution there? McLuhan would call it a Copernican revolution almost. Compared to chemistry, like there is chemical elements are tabulated, then McLuhan makes a chart of the new larger mixture of substance, which are media.
Yeah. Okay, but remember that it sounds to me like when you're talking about a mixture of substances, it sounds to me like you are emphasizing the substances rather than the middle. And what when McLuhan says the medium is the message, McLuhan is saying that the medium between the substances is actually what makes the substances, not the reverse.
Yes.
And so McLuhan is saying that if you make this somersault in thought and think about the middle, that is to say the media, then you can see how to conceptualize this space.
Yeah, so there's the difference, quite different from chemistry. That's looking at the substances, and they're missing the interval. Now, wasn't Claude Bernard, he discovered the interior landscape, McLuhan thought. He started to intuit the electric middle, would you say?
Yes, but, you know, he didn't. All he did was begin to talk about the interior landscape. Mm. He just used the phrase.
Yeah.
So it would be wrong to say that he discovered it first, because the interior landscape has always been active and always will be active. So what Bernard did was use a phrase that then became useful as a way of looking at what the contemporaneous poets in France were doing.
And yeah, it's a way of pointing to the middle.
Correct.
So the middle gets more and more noticed by, made by scientists, noticed by the poets. Then McLuhan charts it out. So what do we have with McLuhan? Is it applied knowledge?
Well, it could be applied knowledge, but right now it's not knowledge at all in the sense of something shared.
Yeah.
It's just right now it's just marks on a page or a voice on tapes or a face in video, all of which McLuhan left and which is left to the future to learn from. And it's what we are trying to do, at least in my perspective, what we are trying to do is we're trying to expose a McLuhan that is not known, but a McLuhan whose potential communication to us is what he called the key to the modern world.
Yeah, and your title of your blog, McLuhan New Science, is very, very apt, because he told me through the evergreens, I like to go into the artistic and the manipulating satire part of himself, but he pointed out to me that, Bob, my real desire was to get a science started, a new science. And he said, I wanted to be known as a scientist, not in the old sense, but it's, you know, he was romanticized by the aesthetes and that in the 1670s as a poet. And they didn't get the science part of him. And that's what he wanted to know, wanted to be, and he failed in getting that. Anybody else really getting that, but you're starting it or developing it, and you got the right title, McLuhan's New Sciences, right?
Yes, well, lately my posts are all about what I call a new genus of sciences. I haven't used that phrase in posts that have been published, but I'm working on you know, three or four different posts. That's what I'm always working on multiple posts at the same time. And the posts that I'm working on, the multiple posts, have to do with a new genus of sciences.
Yeah, G-E-N-U-S.
Correct.
And what does that word mean?
Well, a new species of science would be a sibling to existing sciences. But for McLuhan, all of the existing sciences belong to a single genus.
Yeah.
So a genus is a wider family than a species. So the genus of the intellection of the Western tradition is what McLuhan called the Gutenberg galaxy.
And what that's a genus.
That's right. And he wanted to point out that there are other galaxies. Now, these other galaxies can be called genera. That is the plural of genus.
Yes.
So the whole idea that there are other ways of experiencing the world and of approaching the world scientifically, that's a very difficult thing to do because of the invisibility of these other genera. So the reason that at the start of this conversation, the reason that we got into the scientific revolution around 1800 was that at that time you had an environment that was, active and always had been active, but it was invisible. completely invisible.
Yeah.
Nobody knew anything about it. But in the 200 years since, the whole of modern world and every one of its aspects has been developed out of that environment that gradually became visible.
Yes.
Right? An environment that was already there but unknown. So according to McLuhan, the reason that it's so important to look at the development of literacy in Greece or the development of printing in Germany or the development of chemical elements in France, the reason those revolutions are so important for McLuhan is that they are applicable to the present. We are undergoing a scientific revolution as we speak, but it's in regard to an environment that's invisible. And what is the invisible environment? The invisible environment is the role of media in the creation of human history.
Right. Now, someone like Sheldrake's morphogenetic field, he is discussing, he's tapping into McLuhan's new science without proper preparation via McLuhan. Do you agree?
Well, I don't know anything about him, so.
Oh, okay. Well, there's these different efforts at making a new science, which regular science didn't, old science didn't like. It was too woo-woo sounding. And Sheldrake's morphogenetic field, maybe you can look it up, is a prime example that a lot of people since the 80s refer to or quote when trying to talk about we know as tactile space. But they put it into a lot of weird, often they fall into astral or psychic references or occult mm-hmm. references. But
yeah.
It's a material. And they missed that part, the material interplay of cause and effect in this invisible. But you see, one effect of the electric environment is they begin to notice there's something invisible. They didn't notice that before.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, when an environment is emerging out of its invisibility, all sorts of people have a sense of this and make attempts to articulate it. But the great problem that McLuhan saw was that people are continually falling back into the Gutenberg galaxy, and they're attempting to ground their sense of what's going on in a conceptuality that contradicts where they want to go. And this is not, I mean, you can see this at the University of Toronto, for example, where people didn't understand what was going on with McLuhan and rejected him and all this sort of stuff. But this is a tempest in a teapot. For McLuhan, the great problem is people with nuclear bombs are also confused in the same way.
Yeah.
And if they're allowed sort of free rein with their confused conceptuality, we can all end up dead.
Yes.
So for McLuhan, this was a very, very serious business. And what he was trying to do was communicate these things in a way that wouldn't be just a sense of the new environment. It would actually illuminate the new environment.
Yeah.
But there were several great difficulties involved in this. One of them is the direction of illumination. What McLuhan said was, the direction of illumination is to us, not from us. And it's very, very, very difficult for people to make that turn from it's coming to me and I must accord with it, rather than it's coming from me and it must accord with me.
Yeah. That gets into psychobabble, the from me.
Well, not only that, but it's when there's nothing that is ultimately intelligible about the Gutenberg galaxy. So that the more people think about what needs to be articulated, the more confused they get, the more desperate they get. And what you see as a result of that is modern society, where nobody knows what the hell is going on with anything.
Okay, would
right?
you call...
Politics,
Now, here's a question. He called the electric environment the new, beyond Gutenberg, as a Marconi galaxy. Would you use that term? Are we in a third level? You know, a digital galaxy, but we might have a term for it than digital. But or do you think this, what we're in now, is included by the phrase Marconi galaxy?
Well, remember that the only galaxies that are worth talking about have always been active. So if we talk about, coming into a galaxy, it's not that the galaxy itself is new. It's that our awareness of the galaxy is new.
Yeah.
So
does Marconi help us? Does that help us articulate what we know, what we're noticing?
Yes, of course. But the I already talked about the difficulty involved in turning to illumination rather than trying to cause illumination.
Yeah.
But another great difficulty is the following. If the electric is essentially tactile space in the middle, if the electric is the intuition of the importance of media as middles, then the idea that the electric goes beyond the visual doesn't work, because if the electric is opposed to the visual, that's no longer electric. That's no longer tactile. That's falling back into the visual.
Yeah.
Right? So the great problem for the articulation of these spaces or of these galaxies is that the articulation needs to be what McLuhan called inclusive. The articulation cannot exclude the visual and the audible spaces from tactile space. Tactile space is the awareness of not only the value of visual and audible space, it's the awareness of their reality. And this, the great complexity here is that people want to have a basis in their life that is stable, and McLuhan is pulling the carpet out from under that, and he's saying, no, the reality itself is unstable. Reality itself is this kind of play of spaces which can never be brought into some sort of unity.
Exactly.
Reality itself is plural.
Yeah, it can't be brought into a homogeneity.
Correct.
Okay, so looking at your three types of space. Now, you've described what you write, but I will just repeat some of the sentences to show that you've been saying what you wrote. You say, all experience is some ratio of visual audible, that's hyphenated, visual audible space, where the hyphen or frontier or resonant interval is tactility. So the middle, the hyphen between visual and audible, is tactility. Then you have three quotes. The world of touch, you quote from McLuhan's Through the Vanishing Point, page 221. The world of touch, whether passive or active, creates a relation not of connectedness, but of interval. That's what the world of touch does. So it's not the contact or kinetic pressure part of touch. It's the ineffable. Then part two, your second example, is from Bruce Power's book, Global Village, The Global Village, and you have the quote, the resonant interval may be considered an invisible borderline. See, it's not a visible borderline. Invisible borderline between visual and acoustic space. And then again from Global Village, that quote was page 4. Then on page 13, you say, touch or tactility is the resonant interval or frontier of change and process and is indispensable for the study of technological effects. So basically, you're repeating yourself with a slight nuance to push it along into a clearer view of the invisible middle in those three quotes. And then you redo it again. You say, the play of this threefold unfolds as follows. And I'm not going to go into that, but you talk about the tetrad, and anybody can read the details. But it always comes back. Let's see how you end it. You quote, the bias of our, this is from Counterblast, page 64, 1969. The bias of our culture is precisely to isolate the bias of all others in an effort at orchestration. So the effort at orchestration is the bias of our time. I call that the tetrad manager. Then you say, it is, quote, the medium that is the message, unquote, also known as the interface that is the basis, also known as the medium is the message, is also known as, quote, the gap itself that is the bond of being, also known as tactile space. So those one, two, three, four, or five, one, two, three, four, that, according to McLuhan, those four provides the focus needed to spark this inaugurating event. Then you say, quoting Joyce Mallory in the press, that's an interior landscape, 1953 or so, you say, every medium of communication is a unique art form which gives salience to one set of human, in brackets, visual audio possibilities, and then in brackets, as determined by the tactile interface of their hyphen at the expense of another set. So it gives salience to one set at the expense of another set. Each medium of expression profoundly modifies human sensibility in many unconscious and unpredictable ways. Then you end by saying, the moment man accepts himself as an object, he is free to encounter a multiplicity of spaces created by himself and his technologies. It is the environments and unique spaces created by man's own technologies that have to become especially the concern of the present age of ecology. And that's from 1971, an article called Innovation is Obsolete. Then you have your footnotes, which, with other words, say the same point, but you're always emphasizing, let's see if your final note, note 11, says it. McLuhan simply has have become here in a previous sentence, not have to become, but have become, rather than have to become. He was thinking chiefly the concern in anthropology to understand cultures from the inside. At the same time, however, he was acutely aware that the methods and understandings of the social sciences remained chaotically unfocused. That concern with the inside of culture had been initiated was very important, even a condition for further advance. But such concern could not genuinely advance without collective insight into, there it is, the elements and phenomenal manifestations of that inside, another word for the middle, nor without the ongoing investigation that would result from that insight. So you pile the words on words to, like spiraling over the same insight, which begins with realizing there's visual and an audible space, and there's something in between them that people are becoming more aware of in the electric age because it extended the middle.
Right. So remember that what I'm trying to talk about is an environment that has always been there, always will be there, and is active as we speak.
Right.
So if you think about structure, just a visual slash audio, where the slash is tactile space, it seems obvious to me that there are many ways in which that structure can express itself. And it was this that I tried to talk about with you when we were at Mark Stallman's place. The visual slash audio can have an emphasis on the visual. It can also have an emphasis on the audio. It can also have an emphasis on the middle. And the emphasis in each one of these cases can be an extreme emphasis or a weak emphasis. And so what you end up with looking at this structure is a kind of Mendeleev's table of the elementary ways in which human experience unfolds.
And so Understanding Media, that book is Mendeley's chart.
Well, it's a book concerned with what happens when you look at the world in this way. So it's the effects of Mendeley's chart.
Okay. So did he ever produce Mendeley's chart in a visual sense?
No, I don't think so. By the way, if you try to do it in a visual sense, then you've contradicted yourself.
Yeah.
Right? So that doesn't work. That's one of the problems. Right? There's four or five central problems to doing this. One is the individual has to turn around. Another is that turning around induces confusion. Right, McLuhan often talked, like Jordan Peterson does, of the fact that identity loss results in violence.
Yeah.
Well, when you turn from the Gutenberg galaxy to the Marconi galaxy, you lose identity, and so it's inherent to what's going on at the present in this. Historic change to a new environment. Violence is inherent to it. That's a huge problem.
Yes. So let's go over to my book, because how am I doing with trying to illustrate the tech body? What is the tech body? Is that something beyond the Marconi? Is it an awareness of something new, a new space, new elements? That's what I'd be wondering as I'm reading through this, how close I get to that, or what do I get to that?
I think at least for me, the central question in your book has to do with the Trump or how contemporary events relate to technology in its deepest sense.
Yep.
So I would say that what's interesting about the book and what's interesting about your mind in general is that you have a very highly developed intuition. So you've known for, I would say, at least 50 years that something was going on that you had to articulate, and you've just kept doing it like a bulldog.
That's right.
And that's very interesting. So your pamphlet here is just one of the latest attempts to continue doing that.
That's right. And McLuhan was like that. He was a bulldog as he acted out or mimed the post-visual communication.
Or absolutely.
The Marconi.
So he was a bulldog who was very sick for the last 20 years of his life, and who was mocked by many of his colleagues, and was not able to talk to his own children. Whose books were up until the middle 60s, his books were always rejected by people. McLuhan had a much more difficult life than is generally known.
Yes, that's right. And I've had a very easy life compared to the struggles he had. Because I always had a partner who had great health cures. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So he had a lot of health, you know, stresses and strains that caused all these health problems. He had no proper knowledge around him to alleviate the physical strains he was going through.
That's right. Notice that McLuhan did have a wonderful wife.
Yeah,
and it was Corinne that provided the sort of a material basis, if you will, that looked after everything that needed to be looked after to keep just concrete life going. She did all of that, and she was able to let Marshall know that she greatly appreciated his work, but she wanted him to press on with it further.
Yeah.
That there were aspects to it and to his personality which were only funny, right? And Corinne was able to show Marshall that there were stupid things that he was doing, but that was okay.
Did you say funny?
That's a wonderful.
You said funny.
Funny and stupid, both.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing to have your balloon punctured, but in a way that you can keep going.
Yeah, she was a good doctor for him with the knowledge they had in that day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it.
She was a different, very different kind of doctor than your wife.
Yeah. But for him, he could not have. He would have died without her a long time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Because he was. He wanted to be a family man. A good. She used to say he was in love with the idea of being a family man, but he wasn't too good at it.
Yeah.
He was too driven.
That's true. Well, he liked the idea of being a family man,
yeah.
But he didn't have time for it.
That's right. I was just saying that somebody asked me, or someone brought up something, and I said, well, you remind me of someone I knew when I was very young, and then they came and visited us in Toronto, and you know, when we're adults and all that. And at one point, I was with her by myself, and she said, Bob, how come you and Carol never had any children? I said, oh, we were too busy doing. We had too many things to do, so we had the alibi that McLuhan had. We didn't even get to having. He had children, but no time for them. We didn't even get to having children. We do. We eventually got foster twins when they were 16. So that was a good time. It was all past the growing pain, so to speak, of babies and stuff. But the Ion points out of that big complimentary assistant to McLuhan, which was very necessary, was Marge Stewart. She was the perfect secretary for him, and dictaphone. I don't know if you know much about her.
No, I don't. You've often mentioned her, and you've often mentioned how important she was for McLuhan, but I never met her, and I know that somebody had to make sense of his notes and his dictaphone stuff. Somebody had to correct his spelling and his sentences. And so that was probably her.
It was. Ian makes a big deal out of her understanding of McLuhan, at least to get it down right and to correct where he was sloppy, because a lot of it was repeated, so she knew it very well, you know. So she knew what he was saying all the time and kept it very perfect. And so I gives her a lot of credit for the creativity in the coach house. So McLuhan, he needed that kind of support no matter where he was. At home, he had Corinne. At work, he had Marge.
Yeah, well, everybody who wants to think creatively, where there is an inherent sort of imbalance, that imbalance needs to be offset in some other way or some other ways.
Yeah.
And so what we're talking about are the other ways in which McLuhan's inherent imbalance was offset.
What was the last two words? Was
offset.
Offset, right.
Yeah.
No, that's correct. So on page 130, that's if you get your book up there, your copy. We do the middle. I think we did the important quote from Counterblast, page 135. quote, and no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall, for right. it is not accessible to the mass media. I think we did that, right?
Yeah, well, we talked about it briefly, but I want to read you a passage that I found. I'm just looking for it now. Rats. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Your passage talks about the citadel of individual consciousness and how it's not accessible to mass media. And if you recall, we've also talked about pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah.
So in your quotation here from Counterblast, mass media is something like a tribal environment.
Yes.
Right? So because we're talking about something that is inaccessible to a tribal environment, to mass media. For a tribal environment, I found several quotations from 1970 that talked about how when literature was introduced around the time of Plato, that this recalled, McLuhan said, metaphysical man or pre-tribal awareness.
And, did you send these? Did you send these to me?
Yes.
So I should be able to find.
Yeah, those are we talked about those. Not sure if it was in the last discussion or before that, but I we talked about the fact that in your book you have that quotation from Rolling Stone.
I think
in 1970 or 71.
70.
And then, yeah, 70. Okay. And then I found McLuhan himself talking about pre-tribal awareness in letters, one to Joe Keough, and I forget who the other one was written to.
Yeah, let me see. I see that. I do have your Keough. So I found the quote. So go ahead and read them.
Yeah. Okay, so what I want to read to you is a quotation from 1943.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 30 years before.
Yeah.
And I believe that McLuhan already in his Nash thesis saw the point at issue. Here's what he says. He says, just as language offers an extensive and complex apprehension of the structure of beings, so that faculty which produced the state of language is perpetually operative, an intuitive perception of essentials.
Wow.
So yeah. What he is saying here in 1943 is that human beings have a sense that is prior to language.
Yeah.
And I believe it's amazing that he had that idea so early.
Yeah, now how'd you find that? Okay, you got everything, you can scan everything?
Yeah, but I have lots of stuff that I can search through, but that's not how I found this. I kind of forget how I found this. I was looking for something else, and I found a passage in the Nash thesis that was more or less what I was looking for, and then just by chance on the same page I saw this.
Wow.
So I wasn't looking for it, but it was looking for me.
Yeah But is that Illumination 2?
That's right.
Yeah, rather
Absolutely.
Than from.
Yeah.
Okay, so read it again.
Okay, just as language, and we should, with each part of the sentence, we should do a short commentary. Excuse me. Just as language offers an extensive and complex apprehension of the structure of beings, So what McLuhan is saying there is that every language, it doesn't matter if it's Swahili or it's Hawaiian or it's English, but every language structures the environment in a certain way and gives you access to the environment in a certain way.
Okay, now read it again with that those words in mind.
Okay, just as language offers an extensive and complex apprehension of the structure of beings.
Right. From that language, in that particular language.
Yeah. And so notice, and what's important to see there is nobody invents language. The language is already there. And so when a child learns language, they learn this extensive and complex apprehension of the structure of beings, right? So the child in learning language is introduced to a certain order of the world.
Yes.
Okay. So then McLuhan says, language is already there, and it already has this structure of the world built into it. So he says that.
Okay, so that he didn't say that. That's what he meant. You're translating. So now you're going to read the second sentence.
Yeah. So the second clause of this same sentence. This is all one sentence. So at the start of the first clause, he says, "Just as language." And so now he's going to say, so that faculty, right? So the thing about just as language is that it's already there and it already offers a complex apprehension. So he says, just as language, so that faculty which produced this state of language is perpetually active, operative. So language is already there. And it already offers this sort of window into the world.
To you.
That's right, to you. But in order for that to be possible, says McLuhan, so that faculty which produced this state of language is perpetually operative. So there has to be a window onto the world that is prior to the window of the world that is language, that allows language to be learned in the first place and then to be used.
Okay, with those words in mind, read the second clause.
The second clause is, so, just as language, so that faculty which produced this state of language is perpetually operative.
Mm. Wow. Is that the end of the sentence?
No, then there's a dash. And then he sums up what that is, an intuitive perception of essentials. Now, what does he mean by essentials? He means that when language gives us a window onto the world, it gives us a window onto a world that's structured in various ways. And the structure of things, that is to say, the form of things, can be called its essentials. So essential and form and structure all belong together.
Yeah.
So McLuhan is saying that it belongs to human beings to have an intuitive, as to say, it's not instructed. It's not something that is subject to education. It's something that's already there and already active, and it's that which allows human beings to learn language and thereby become human beings.
Yeah, the essentials are in the middle.
Well, that's right. The this faculty, which is perpetually operative, that's McLuhan around this time would have called that logos.
Yeah.
And so the logos is something that's active outside of us, but we also have a kind of shadowy faculty that's related to that big L logos, call it small L logos. And that small L logos is what ties us to the world. And insofar as it's a tie, it is a medium. It's one possible media.
Yeah, and that is he. I think it's in Catholic Humanism. He says, if it wasn't inside us, we wouldn't be able to know it.
Correct.
That's a simple way of saying, summing up what you said, what you're quoting. But you can see some other articles that I'm aware of that he wrote in that time. He talks about being. For him, being is that middle space.
You're talking about being, B-E-I-N-G?
Yeah. He talked about the non-being of non-being.
Yeah.
He used the word being and something else, but it's being and something else, reality or nature or something.
Yeah. So the interesting thing, and this is yet another problem that is in the way of this turn that we're talking about, another great problem that stands in the way of this illumination and practice of new science is that the sort of the central characteristic of being is that it gives itself up. So Christ on the cross is one articulation of this insight.
Yeah.
And it is that human beings are not related to being through matching or through merger. Human beings are set free to have diverse relationships to being. So being is not something that insists on being glued. It's a dynamism. It opens itself freely, even to its own denial.
Hendiades, one by means of two, but
yes,
it includes the third, the middle.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the structure of being. It's just what you were saying there, that the one. In order to be, outers itself as two, and the relationship between the one and the two is a third.
Right. So until you get that, McLuhan doesn't make sense, especially his 40s writing. Very hard to understand.
But what's interesting about the 40s writing is that for McLuhan himself, those writings had to be interrogated. As I say, he himself didn't understand entirely what the hell he was talking about.
Yeah, and so he thought he had to discover something new, which was Innes.
Yeah, well, Innes was a great help to McLuhan to understanding understanding this stuff.
That's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He thought he was discovering something new. He was just getting a way to clarify what he'd already been saying.
Yeah, in a certain way, but the it's not as if it would be very Gutenbergian to say it was all there and nothing new ever happened.
Right.
But for McLuhan's thinking, no, new stuff was happening all the time, but also nothing new was happening. So all new and nothing new were always going on.
Yeah, so he would constantly call Barry Nevitt in the middle of the night and say, I made a breakthrough. To Barry, it was something he already said years ago before. But there was a new aspect in Marshall's perceiving of it. So maybe Barry picked up on that and tolerated these interruptions.
Yeah. McLuhan was a guy that really didn't have anybody to talk to. He would talk to people like Nevitt, and in my own view, I don't think Nevitt really understood what McLuhan was talking about. He understood parts,
yeah,
but didn't understand the full picture. And so what happens when you want to talk about somebody you didn't really understand, and you know that you really didn't understand them, you can either say, well, you know, I was ignorant of what was going on, sort of take the Socratic approach, or you can say, well, I'll tell funny stories about the guy and I won't dwell on my own ignorance.
Yeah.
And most people choose the latter. Most people say, well, you know, he may have known some things, but he was kind of an oddball. And,
yes.
I knew better in most respects.
Yeah, that's right. And so when you spoke to me and Mark, you had the sense that we didn't get what you were saying, I imagine.
Sure. Well, I knew that you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I had you gave me your book, and I knew from some of the things that you were saying that had an intuition of some of the things that I had an intuition about. And so it was a little bit disappointing to me that I was unable to sort of reach across and communicate with you. On the other hand, I'd already had at least 30 years of the same experience, so it didn't surprise me or depress me.
Right. And then we had further incomprehension when we were reading.
Correct.
You reading me. So when did we first have our first recorded talk? Was it 2015 or was that our second phase? No, I think it was 2015 or so. We first talked and recorded, and then we were beginning to see something that we could understand. And we did that for many years, or a couple of years. Then we had a few years, and then it was just a year or so ago you said, oh, wait a minute, we can do this again, because you recognize the meteorological level versus the chemical level. That was about a year or two ago, I think.
Yes, at least a couple of years, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so
I think that's roughly right, what you just said.
Yeah, so, yes, I think that you could notice from my book or something, that if anybody's going to understand you, it might be Bob, right? if we just wait it out.
The way this new science works is that you cannot come to understand it without already understanding it.
Yeah.
This is another one of the difficulties involved. There are different senses of time that are involved in this new science, which are very difficult for most people. So the fact that you already understand things that are very important to McLuhan means that we can talk because you don't need to achieve the understanding. The understanding is already there.
That's right. So let's go over, let's look at some of the quotes you have here. Joe Keough, you know, in the November 18th email, pre-tribal awareness.
Yeah, I'm just trying to. Go ahead. I'll find it. I'm just.
Okay. So you have here Joe Keough, July 6, 1970. Page 413 in letters. McLuhan says to Joe, Havelock's preface to Plato shows how the phonetic alphabet scrapped tribal man but retrieved the primordial role of individual and pre-tribal awareness.
Right.
So that's a good one. So
So let's comment on that just for a minute. How does that retrieval work? Well, it retrieves by enacting. That is to say, you could not make the transition without that transition being a possibility. So everybody in tribal societies all over the world had been enacting tactile space, you could say, simply because human beings are not possible outside of tactile space. They're always doing it, right? So when you put together words, when you understand somebody else, when you grow up, when you cook things, when you discover a new way to hunt an animal or something. All of these things presuppose tactile space, but that tactile space is not illuminated, and it's certainly not conscious. So what McLuhan's saying here is with the transition to the phonetic alphabet, tactile space got emphasized. And why? Because it was the biggest change that had ever happened to human beings.
Yeah.
Right? So when you have the biggest change, then something is illuminated for retrieval.
Yes. So that explains that quote. So then the next one, he says, so he has this on his mind in 1970. So a month later, August 17th, 1970, he writes to Lynn White, and this is in Andrew...
Crystal.
Yeah, Andrew Crystal's thesis, page 207. So McLuhan writes to White, the liquidating of the tribal encyclopedia of the bards was done by phonetic literacy, but there was retrieved something of great antiquity, namely pre-tribal metaphysical man. Wow. Here it is. He's saying this stuff. You know, I see that quote in 1970 from Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And then I don't see the Joe Keough and that until 88, 87 when the letters come out. And I don't know if I got it right away back then. I think I did later. I would read this, say, oh, yeah, that's the, Rolling Stone point. But I didn't know Andrew's thesis. I have a copy of it, but I don't recall reading this in Andrew's thesis. I may have. Or I have different versions of his thesis. Anyways, that's a good find. And then you have in his book with Bruce Powers, 1976, 77, he's composing it. There's a note in the Global Village. Is it in the book?
Yes.
Yeah, a note. Oh, you mean a note at the bottom of the page?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or at the end of the chapter. I forget if they have end notes or footnotes.
Right. It says the electronic society, ... can become boundless, directionless, falling easily into the dark of the mind and the world of primordial intuition. Loss of individualism invites once again the comfort of tribal loyalties. And that's where we are today, right? Electronic society can become boundless, directionless, falling easily into the dark of the mind and the world of primordial intuition. And loss of individualism invites once again the comfort of tribal loyalties. So we retrieving that pre-tribal metaphysical man is a major effort of understanding or comprehension today.
That's right. But it's also tremendously difficult, and because it involves identity loss before you can have new identity gain, it involves violence. And so you have people cutting themselves, for example,
yeah,
or taking extreme amount of drugs or something. But at the national level, you have the potential of extreme forms of war. So
this is
what is happening today, but this darkness is something that's extremely threatening.
Yeah, and everybody is searching for retrieving that individual metaphysical state, but they put it in cultural terms, either visual bias or tribal bias. And they don't get the, I don't want to say the pure condition, but they don't get to the middle. That's the problem here. And you see it,
exactly.
You can see
exactly
all the therapies. All the therapies don't get it. You know, all the cultural efforts.
All right. So let's just tie that to how we began the conversation today. The environment itself, and therefore the way to that environment, and therefore the application that becomes possible on the basis of that environment, all those things are invisible.
Yeah.
They're just as invisible as literature was before Plato, just as invisible as printing was before Gutenberg, just as invisible as the chemical elements were before Lavoisier. So we're dealing with that invisibility and its consequences.
And you could say just as McLuhan is invisible.
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so you then have a quote from the first version of Counter Blast, 1954. And you say, or you quote, "Until writing," and writing is capitalized, "until writing was invented, we lived in acoustic space where the Eskimo now lives. Boundless, directionless, horizonless, the dark of the mind, the world of emotion, primordial intuition, terror." Then you put in tribal, question mark, right? That's you putting that in there. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Then the next sentence. "Speech is a social chart of this dark bog." Speech is a social chart of this dark bog. You have that question, tribal, again. "Speech structures the abyss of mental and acoustic space, shrouding the race." Now, that's the whole thing of that quote from 1943 goes into what capital speech is and what we started talking about, the act of speech and in the middle. That's what structures the abyss of mental and acoustic space shrouding the race. It is a cosmic, invisible architecture of the human dark. Radio returns us to the dark of the mind, to the invasions from Mars and Orson Welles. It mechanizes the well of loneliness that is acoustic space, and you have in brackets, you put in pure acoustic space. The human heartthrob put on a PA system provides a well of loneliness in which anyone can drown. Okay, so in light of what we've been saying, that's kind of obvious what he's saying. And if you understand us, you would get it. So then you say, now this might be the test, the sum of all that we've read in the quotes, you say the sum, question mark, then you say, "Individual and pre-tribal awareness equals metaphysical man, equals primordial intuition." And that would be the essentialities, the essentials that you quoted in, from 1943. Individualism equals the dark of the mind, equals the world of emotion, primordial intuition and terror, equals the human dark, equals the well of loneliness, equals the human heartthrob in which anyone can drown. So you're asking if that's the sum. So,
yeah, I should say that I was using the equal sign there in a way that's probably wrong.
Yeah,
I was saying both equal and not equal.
Yeah, yeah, you were failing to. You should have just put hyphen.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, hyphen is middleness. So this integral awareness is the goal here, always the goal all through all the cultures. And I think McLuhan says that it almost has a renaissance potential today for more and more people to get that individual awareness because of the overload they're stuck in, the paralysis they're stuck in. It's so extreme. They could pop out of it. And I hear Ion saying that. In their terms, they said, the only way out of this mess we're in is ascension. And then ascension has a lot of different ways Ion expresses it. That doesn't mean, you know, vertical awareness or horizontal. But I think McLuhan is getting at ascension, the condition of, you know, you could say pure citadel of consciousness. Once it's worked through all these extensions of the middle. So you have pure acoustic space. There may be pure tactile space, which would be recognizing it. It's not invisible.
Right, right. That's what that, when we started off our conversation with the three kinds of space posts that I did, that's what I was talking about with the three kinds of space and their interrelationships.
Right, so you make a simple statement at the beginning of the Three Spaces blog And then you got to spiral through these more complex statements, including the 1943 essay. And if you can surf those, then you arrive at what the simple statement you start off with was. But you need to go through these variations that can trip up your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So then you say, the Gutenberg galaxy retrieves this individualism, and that's in quotes, because it's not pure, when it eventually finds that the subject is an empty fiction. And you say, after subject, it's subject. So the Gutenberg galaxy retrieves this individualism, in quotes, individualism, when it eventually finds that the subject, its subject, is an empty fiction. Right.
Right.
That's the bias of visual extension.
Yeah, so notice that that's kind of a bookend to the earlier quotation from the letter to Joe Keel.
Yeah.
Because he says that the phonetic alphabet scrapped tribal man but retrieved primordial role of individual and pre-tribal awareness. So you could say that that's at the start of the phonetic alphabet revolution. The individual and pre-tribal awareness was emphasized by taking advantage of its leverage.
Yes, of the alphabetic leverage.
That's right. But at the other end of the Gutenberg galaxy, that leverage turns against itself.
Yep.
Right? So at the start, you have the advantage, and at the end, you have the disadvantage.
Yes. And that's because you've been hypnotized the whole way through, and you still got to deal with that hypnosis, paralysis. Mm-hmm. And it's even the pressure's even more so because you retrieve tribal comforts, which are what Ion says. The tech body gives everybody comforts at any service, any level, instantly. So
that's right. It's not just negative hypnotism. It's a hypnotism that enables stuff like modern medicine.
Yeah.
You guys have a company that is very much involved with modern medicine and what we know about how the body needs to take care of itself.
Yeah, so you said you guys. You mean me and Carolyn?
Yeah. So that hypnotism has two sides to it. Everything, because we want to look at the middle, everything possible has its upside and its downside. And the Gutenberg galaxy is like this.
That's right. Ion always says there's two conversations in every issue.
Yeah, good. That's right.
So you got one more quote. So speech would be the addition of some limited visuality to overwhelming orality. So speech would be the addition of visuality or some limited visuality to overwhelming orality, and literacy would be the mining of this visuality for use. Yes, that's a question. And the electric would be the mining of orality for use, threatening to become the complete loss of visuality into the boundless, directionless, horizonless, dark of the mind, the world of emotion, primordial intuition, and terror. Correct. I would agree with that. So there's the traps. What's he call it? Elephant traps and Indian lion cages or something?
Yeah.
So this is how you talk about awareness today, what we're doing. If you don't include the factors we're including in our talk, you're not getting there. You're not defining the problem. You're not defining the cage you're in correctly.
Yeah, you're not emerging into new science, which is the discernment of the environment.
Condition.
Yeah, in which we've always lived.
Yes. So,
and if you think about it in ontological terms, what we need to do is we need to get away from ontology as some kind of choice between materialism and idealism, and realize that ontology has to do with the middle ground,
yeah,
with the tactile between those things, with the generation of those things. And in order to see that, you have to go through all of the sorts of problems that we've discussed.
Yeah, I'm thinking that the tech body maybe really erases the middle to extreme, and it's very hard to figure out the middle with the tech body environment. So let's see if I get to that, or if
sure.
that's the right way to say it. So mm-hmm. I'm talking here on page 130, and I guess I'll just, I don't know how much we did in 130, but I'll just start off here after the counterblast quote, "For it is not accessible to the mass media." So I go, no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall. That's what McLuhan says. And then I say, Gnosticism believes it did fall, for it is not accessible to the mass media, unquote. Then I go, more autonomy for the individual. We're beginning to move into the, quote, autonomous anthropomorphic physical, or AP, social effect. It's not blatant anthropomorphic physical, but I've explained that memes are also coming out of it. I'm attempting to describe how both conditions are happening, the Android meme and the anthropomorphic physical. The merger parallel to the separate intelligence, which you would call the middle. These five separateness quotations above help to illustrate McLuhan's vision of what's unfolding toward full development. Then I ask, final cause. So that's a lot of garble there. I want to see what my next quote says, if it helps explain this. So I'm taking a quote from Cliched Archetype, page 200.
Yeah, very good quotation.
Yeah, the expressionist, that's 1910, 1920, the expressionist had discovered that the creative process is a kind of repetition of the stages of apprehension, somewhat along the lines that relate Coleridge's primary and secondary imagination. In the same way, there would seem to be an echo of the formative process of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious. Read that again. In the same way, there would seem to be an echo of the formative process of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious. This, in turn, implies a close liaison between private and corporate awareness, though which exerts the most effect on the other may depend entirely on the degree of awareness achieved. That's talking middle there.
Yeah, that's, I hadn't realized this before, but this is really talking about the same thing as that 1943
yes.
quotation.
Yeah.
Right? That's when he talks about the formative process of consciousness and how that is unconscious.
Yeah, read what he says if you have it there. Read that again.
Momentito. He says, just as language offers an extensive and complex apprehension of the structure of beings, so that faculty which produced this state of language is perpetually operative.
Wow.
An intuitive perception of essentials. And he seems to be saying basically the same thing, but in different language.
Yeah. It's,
right?
It's simpler. He gets a little simpler. Later.
Yeah. Well, because the first expression of anything is always unclear.
Yeah.
The first expression of something always demands some precision.
That's right.
Bob, I'm going to just walk to another room here. We're looking after one of our neighbor's dogs.
Okay.
Over in Paris. And I can hear that the dog may need something, so I'm just going to.
There might be some noise in the background. Okay.
Yeah.
So what was I going to say? The Yeah, McLuhan says to me, when I spoke to him through the Evergreens, he said, and I was quoting from that period, the early 50s, he said, I was not as clear back then. He actually says that. Yeah, I was not as clear. In other words, he hadn't really got it. He hadn't processed Innes clearly. Or maybe he needed to get that contact with Ted Carpenter, with the Eskimo knowledge, in the late 50s. That might have helped him. So you like to see him not really getting it really clearly until 1960.
Oh, I think that's true. He says that himself, that the most important intellectual experiences of his life were in the late 1950s.
Right.
So that's an amazing thing for somebody to say who had a conversion to Catholicism in 1937, and then got exposed to Lewis and Gideon in the early 40s, and to Mallarmé and Innes and Eisenstein in the 40s, to say in the 1950s, after all of that, that he was beginning to get clear. That's really something.
Yeah, well, that shows you the work that has to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the work of the mind right there.
Yeah. I remember Dave Wirth used to say to me, you know, the hardest thing to do is to become aware. And McLuhan spells out the stages of awareness traps. You got to work your way through.
Yes.
That's why you got to read all his work. You got to read all that early stuff to get to the later stuff to see what he went through. And hopefully you're going through it too.
The key word in what you just said is stages.
Yeah.
And it occurs to people sort of automatically that stages or phases must be chronological.
Yeah.
But in McLuhan, they're exactly not chronological.
Exactly. Correct.
Right. So when he talks about stages, he always talks about retrieval and replay.
Yes, that's a simple way to sum up the complexities he's worked his way through. You know, the act of the tetrad, the enhancement, obsolescence, retrieval, and reversal. You got to see that's happening all the time in confronting the invisible.
Correct, and notice that he begins to see that himself only around 1970. So this is 10 years before his death, and he's already 60 years old, and he's just beginning to become clear about what's always been there, but he didn't see it.
Yeah, and you actually, in interview, especially one with Tom Wolfe about 1973, he's actually quite happy-looking, handsome-looking in his face compared to pictures of him in the 50s and 60s. He seems to be radiating this completion. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, in the 60s, he was a really sick guy.
Very tense.
He had something growing in his brain that was causing blackouts and causing forgetfulness. So he was on the brink of death.
Right. And so the fact I selected this quote shows that I was on to what you discovered in 43. You know, I knew that this kind of complexity that he's doing here, you had to parse, as they say. You had to spend time with it.
Sure, but many quotations that you have in the pamphlet here are like that.
Yes.
So, for example, when you pick out the report from Rolling Stone in 1970 and say that that's very important. As far as I know, nobody else has looked at that issue.
That's right.
Yeah, and so that's a very good example of your intuition.
My bulldogness. That's right, my intuition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of being a bulldog is you actually know you're getting it, but you're maybe refining how you express it to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to be open to saying, you know, that was fallacious.
yeah.
I'm going to take that back, but it was something that happened on my way.
Yeah, that's why I liked going to the seminars. They often, on the surface, were repeating an event that repeated itself, but I knew there was always some new nuance going on. So if in my radio show, when I talk, not with Ian, but other people after Ian has left, some surface listening might say, well, Bob keeps saying the same stuff every fucking show. But no, it's not that for me. I'm seeing it clearer every time, especially when you encounter new people who say their awareness evokes a new problem. They got mm-hmm. new mm-hmm. complexities that aren't aware of until you meet them.
Plus, there's external events are continually changing as well.
Yeah, complexifying. So would that be the Socratic process?
Yes, of course. It's a dialogue of the soul with itself.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely what I've been doing all my life. I enjoy doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to have maybe that's what faith is, or grace, is that you enjoy this exploration that reality brings to you.
Yes, I mean, it doesn't, McLuhan, I can't remember where, but McLuhan talks about how experiencing pleasure is essential to this kind of thinking.
Yeah. That's true. And see if you come across, even look it up. I think it's Interior Landscape. I can't find it, but he talks about the hand or the arm resting limpidly. Look at the word limpid. See if you can find that in your, whatever you've got as an inventory. It should show up in Interior Landscape, but I can't find it. But it's interesting how he describes how the hand hangs limpidly. It's that level of pleasure you're talking about. You're in a state of pleasure. Are you looking at it right now?
Well, I'm trying to find it, so...
Okay, I'll keep talking here.
I'm paying attention to you.
Yeah. Okay, so they have that great quote from page 200 in From Cliché to Archetype, and then I go correctly, I say, that's tactility once again, or in your terms, the middle. Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Wordsworth had a letter exchange and debate, but Coleridge was the first to detect, quote, the medium is the message on a very small scale. Then I said, remember, media are the archetypes of the unconscious, and they form the consciousness. Then I have the formative process. There it is again. Then I seem to be quoting McLuhan, who says, in the same way there would seem to be an echo, unquote, of the massaging of consciousness in the entire content of the unconscious, defined as a technological environment. That was the new term for that, for the middle. That's about media massaging us in a complex way. Perhaps trying to play down this process. And I give the quote to say that, to illustrate that. McLuhan says, this in turn implies a close liaison between private and corporate awareness, though which exerts the most effect on the other may depend entirely on the degree of awareness achieved. Now, that's interesting how the effects that you would perceive depends on your degree of awareness. Isn't that the principle of uncertainty? You alter what you see depending on the tool you use.
Right. So we were talking earlier about the difficult dialectic between the initial starting of an environment, then the environment gets developed in various ways, and then people within that environment begin to see it, right? So it's excuse me, it's already there, and then parts of it get seen. Excuse me, I've got a continual frog in my throat. People, normal, everyday people begin to see an environment only very late, but they do get to see it. Because they're living in it.
Yeah, that's romanticized as, you know, people catch on the last year of their life or something, you know, just before they die.
Yeah, they see. Yeah, in the moment of death, seeing your life unfold before you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I then say, after quoting McLuhan and the liaison between private and corporate awareness, you have these two features in consciousness impinging on each other, and somehow the degree of awareness gets the upper hand in shaping the private and the corporate. The more aware you are of the implications of what you're doing, you might have an advantage. That's pretty good. And then I say, I liked this quotation up above because it references the tactile interplay. One aspect is massaging one side, and the other side is being massaged by the previous side, and the degree of awareness is a factor. That's where I get the, quote, audience of the intellect above. What is the audience of somebody exercising for himself? We're getting into this with the world situation today. People aren't going to be able to socialize. They're not going to get anything out of sport in the Zoom culture. They'll wander off. People are going to start wandering off dazed, depending on the degree of awareness achieved. The reason this is about the audience of the intellect and voluntary AP or anthropomorphic physical or voluntary ESP is the fragmenting, the isolating, the walling off of the hive mind, tribal comforts, merged in the cloned ESP. The cloned ESP is the new tribal loyalties or comforts. I presented different sentences that talk about the isolated individual in quotes. And then I then quote McLuhan, 1962, in Prospect magazine. He says, the multiplicity of media, and then I say, there's so much media that the humans can't be conditioned anymore for the first time in history. The person was the victim, McLuhan's words, the servo mechanism of his technology since the beginning of time, unquote. But now the sheer multiplicity of them, of the technologies, she, he is beginning to awaken. She, he doesn't get stuck in any one of them. She, he goes from one to the next. But she, he can't live with them all merged. That's a fragmenting, separating, individualizing effect. Now, that's not healthy in a way. That's a fragmenting, separating, individualizing effect. There's a service and a disservice to that. Are you with me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
We should go to the end of this, but then I think we should go back to its start because there's a lot of meat in what you're talking about here that can be brought out.
Yeah, I'm glad that I got this whole – I'm on an inspired rant here that based on all that we have been talking about, there we have a rant. Bob's all worked up about it. Then we can go over this the next time we talk. Then the second quote, the one from Rolling Stone, cites the ancient individual by himself. We are becoming like that. We became isolated individuals, but, you know, very primitive. Just look at the porn, very primitive. We're caveman people. McLuhan has that theme in the 50s in one of his articles. In War and Peace in the Gold Village, he quotes Finnegan's Wake, quote, it brought the dear prehistoric scenes all back again, as fresh as of yore. And then I say, and that can be all kinds of violent scenes. There's the identity crisis all over the place. And that can be all kinds of violent scenes, cavemen hijacking women and raping them. That was very primitive, very isolating, and perhaps not much social order before a social order was installed. That's another example of the isolated getting kicked out of the cloned ESP environment, that's today, and only engaging ESP when convenient for the person. That's voluntary ESP. One has the loneliness that suggests that it's the separateness of man. The human dimensions are lost during the mechanical era or industrial society of non-human ends, quoting McLuhan, non-human ends. And then quoting McLuhan, while the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers struggle dimly to restore balance and order by homeopathic means. Then I say homeopathic means might be, quote, the word making the market. That's another isolated, fragmenting situation. Holy shit, do I go on? How long does this go on? Let me see. This is ridiculous. Well, it does end. Okay, I'm going to finish it. What a mouthful this is. Okay. And then, remember, I'm actually saying this to my friend.
Yeah.
We're recording it, and I'm explaining it close to him. Okay. And then the third quote, Counterblast, 1968. No matter how many walls have fallen, that should be 1969. No matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall, for it is not accessible to the mass media. So then I say, the basic structure of humans may be private, but then you start creating a society, and they're not so private, not so independent. But McLuhan says, quote, in the end, media don't affect the essence. No, I changed the words, the essence of a person, unquote. That's another idea of isolation and detachment from the merged condition of social communion. One is simulating the ESP which surrounds everybody and penetrates. Now, that would be the middle. The ESP is the middle that people intuit. And go back to the 1943 quote. One is simulating the ESP which surrounds everybody and penetrates, and then I say, I have merged, interpenetrated. That's the popular mythology of ESP, everybody intimately inside each other. It's a merger of humans via the global theater. Then capitalism, the after image of the printing press, couldn't continue to function while everybody's sharing the same disembodied space without having to own anything. You know, the World Economic Forum, they're promising a condition where you won't own anything, where it's been going on for most of the 20th century. The meme of literate individuality started to allow pay TV and Walkmans, and all this a specialized electronic delight. And then the computer digital technology continued to throw people back into isolated, walled-off spaces, which would exaggerate personal consumerism. Accompanying this retrieval of a virtual visual space, which is the patina of the archetypal silent print condition, the Android meme retrieves this. The Android meme digitized and atomized every digital user. That's a popular word, atomize. People use that word today, atomize.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, and that ends that thing, and that's a thing. That's a big wad. holy cow. But I'm sort of taking all the quotes, the two, three, or four quotes above that, and
right,
bouncing them off to each other. So that's useful. Okay,
yeah,
so
no,
I,
there's a lot of good stuff in that.
Yeah, that's,
and the topic, as you say in the first line, is that's tactility.
Yeah, yeah, the middle space, the middle.
Yeah,
they're trying to describe it. So. What else do I want to say? So let's, unless you have some things to say, well, I don't think so. It's too much to talk about right now, and it's time to close. We've gone over 2 hours, so that's pretty good. Running through your quotes, your contribution, and then I echo them.
Yeah.
I
well,
echo
who's
them.
Who's echoing who? I mean, there's a lot of back and forth going on here.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay, so thanks for finding those quotes on the middle, that last bunch of quotes you found in the letters. That was pretty good. Because I used to think that quote, you know, in through the 70s from Rolling Stone was the only time he said it. It wasn't until later did we find the others. And I didn't even find them all. You found some of them that I didn't know about. So it actually became, I thought it was odd that I thought he was just saying it once, you know. How come he doesn't develop it? Well, he does develop it. It takes another 20 years to find the potential to find the quotes.
Mm-hmm. But you see, the way that things work is that we write things or think things or talk things. And then afterwards, we find out what was already there in what we ourselves were saying or writing or thinking, but we didn't know they were there.
That's
so,
what McLuhan
meant. For example, this quote here from Cliché to Archetype that you wrote down, that you selected, this turns out to be a kind of commentary on the Rolling Stone thing that you thought was isolated, but it turns out that you yourself knew that it wasn't isolated.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what McLuhan said, I don't know what I think until I say it.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and that happens with writing. It happens with all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, that's why you don't have to get too much novelty. You just go back and look at what you already did. That's a pretty interesting, you know, to look at it again because it'll be different.
Correct. So that's retrieval, replay, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's my main activity is listening to my thoughts in a large part of my day. And a lot of them are repeated, but they're always new. So I'm going over, you know, it's not, you know, you're not thinking conceptually. You're listening to echoes, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
something that you do when you're on your various shows, or are you talking about something that you do when you're by yourself?
No, I spend a lot of time by myself, and I am not bored at all.
Uh-huh.
I got so much interesting thoughts going through my head because I remember a lot of the interesting sources. So having a good mm-hmm. memory is important because you can remember these things. And
right.
So I find that very the best entertainment. I don't think it's narcissism. It's not narcissism. You're discovering. It's actually a joy to think again.
And is this like shuffling a deck?
Yeah.
And
so what's that other one?
You're conscious. It's an activity that you're consciously and systematically doing?
Yep. I don't have to try. As soon as I wake up, I'm doing it. You know, and I do it all day long. And often if someone listened to me, spied on me all day long for 6 months, they'd see that I was always talking to people where it would sound like the same thing. But I'm always thinking about this same dilemma or solution, be both. But if I start talking to somebody, I don't talk about nonsense or gossip. I'll talk about that stuff and get their reaction to it, which is always interesting. Mm-hmm. Or they'll start telling me their stuff, and it'll translate to me. So I basically have been like McLuhan, just talking my whole fucking life, you know?
yeah. To me, this sounds like that you have a very developed unconscious that is not only is it very active, but it's not entirely unconscious.
That's right. I call it conscious mediumship.
Yeah. Okay, good. So that's exactly what I see you doing with the universe or with the dead. And what you're saying here is that, it's going on. It's sort of the background drama that's going on with everybody all the time.
Yeah,
you have developed a connection with that practically nobody else has.
Yeah, I'm always looking and interacting and smiling with people because I'm thinking they're thinking what I'm thinking. They're not, but I'm aware that that could be going on. They could mm-hmm. be conscious mm-hmm. of it. So sometimes I'll get someone into it. They're not used to come along and meet them on the walkway, a few people. And they're right in the sun having a nice walk, and then they're talking this deep talk, you know. Then I'm ready to go into it at any moment, you know.
What I'm interested in, I'm interested in many aspects of this, but one of the things I'm particularly interested in is how do you – excuse me, have this going on in your mind and in another part of your activity, you're able to make jokes, you're able to talk about stuff that seems to be completely different
right.
from this process. How does that work?
Well, that's the newness of new things that happen every day. And so it's always confirming what you learned the other day, the previous day. The new things are repeating. You're spiraling, right? I guess it's a spiral.
Mm-hmm.
You constantly go around the same circle, the same insight, but there's always new content or new people bringing their bizarre initial perversity to it, and then you refine what they said. There, you get them back on the same page.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that a kind of foreground activity that is very different and very simple compared to the background activity that's going on at the same time?
Yeah.
So, I mean, is there a link between those things, or are you able to do it more or less like a ventriloquist dummy?
It's where, always coming into me. Yes, someone's always sending me the stuff in my mind. I like to say that these aren't my thoughts. These are my neighbor's thoughts. And I'm constantly listening to my neighbor. Because I don't have you can't pin me down to a point of view. So
no, of course, yeah.
So after we do Ion, the short show and the long show, then Ion leaves, and then I start talking to people, and they'll bring up things. They might even say, I was listening to a recording of what you said last week, and they'll quote me, and then I'll have something new to say. And I am quite stunning. People are very, holy shit, Bob, I never heard anything like that. That's amazing. And they're amazed that I keep doing it every week. So I understand the perpetual motion. I've tapped into perpetual imagination in a way.
Yeah, that's.
I assume you have it because you're always writing it. Don't you have it? What'd you say?
I say that's in the quotation. That's what Coleridge calls primary imagination.
Yeah. But don't you have that? You're always writing the same issue all the time in your blog. So aren't you doing that?
Yeah, sure. What you were just calling spiraling.
Yeah. But you're doing it more by yourself. You don't have a social interaction like I do.
No.
Yeah. So
not at all. I know the only person that I can talk to about this on this level is you.
Yeah, glad to. Yeah, it's what would I say? McLuhan started it. I picked up on it. Finally met someone who could do it with me. I do with other people, but they're usually just stunned, and they'll come up with different points. Now, we've been doing it for years, so people have a backlog of quoted memories they can bring in, but they can't talk. They can't start the talk. They don't have any thoughts at the beginning. You know what I mean? I've always got thoughts immediately. You could call me up in 5 hours and we'll fucking do it again, you know?
Sure, of course, yeah, and vice versa.
Right. So, and I think I really don't identify with the content. You know, I'm not, it's effortless. It's not trying to get somewheres, though I am always getting momentary arrivals of delight or pattern recognition, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not stopping. So, and McLuhan, I think, when he said there's no finish line, he was talking about that personally.
Sure.
For himself.
Well, just go back for half a second to the analogy with chemistry. If you think of all of the experiments, all of the discoveries, all of the patents, all of the new products that have happened from 1800 until now, that sort of discovery is also possible in the new environment.
Yeah.
And the new environment is what we're breathing. It's what we're constantly thinking about and taking delight in. It has all of the complexity of what was possible in the old environment.
Yep. And this is what's amazing with Ion. We have many other products we're making, amazing things, new technologies. So Ion has endless talk. It can go on and on and on forever, dealing with all kinds of people. But we are making things. It's not aimless. And so there's many other products that we have on the back burner that are being developed. So it's this endless thinking. Working with Ion, we make environments from it.
Not a boy. That's a good boy.
That's what?
I'm bringing in the dog here.
Oh.
So I'm talking to the dog. At the
no difference. No
Bob.
Difference. Yeah, no, but just that you got my point there is that it's with iron we make things. We externalize our conversation, which is pretty amazing.
But so, aren't we trying to make something? We're trying to make accessible the new environment, the new environment that's perpetually there, that always has been there.
Yeah,
the new environment that is the ancient environment.
We're trying to explain what Bob's doing with ION. That's the hidden agenda. That's what the Tech Body article is about. Because the Tech Body enters in, sometimes takes over ION, which is pretty incredible. So.
Yeah, you see, I know nothing about all that sort of stuff. So that's one of the interesting things about the pamphlet, about how you're going to develop the whole link to the Tech Body. What that has to do with what McLuhan was trying to express.
Yeah, that's where I took a chance. Let's see if McLuhan helps me get there. And so, yeah, that's the task I'm doing for you is, and for the listeners, to see if I do that challenge you just laid out. That's the thing. Yeah, there's something about the Tech Body that I'm trying to point out, but we have to go through this incredible background to get ready for what we're going to do in the last 30 or 40 pages.
Yeah, and plus, one of the best things about McLuhan is that when you make a bet that he's going to help you understand something, that bet almost always pays off.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something for people to enjoy if they want to.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The usual practice with McLuhan is to say, well, I already knew that, or he's repeating himself, or that's wrong.
That's right.
All of those things are nuts.
They're what? Nuts, did you say?
Nuts, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Like, I used to wonder why I enjoyed reading McLuhan's books all through the 70s and 80s, and I didn't have much desire to read anything else because there was so much that was in there, you know, to find. So after a while, I through the years, been around a long time, I've read a lot of other stuff now, but I spent many years just reading McLuhan books, and that was good enough for me. You know, I didn't need a new novel or something.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I'm going to have to ring off because the dog needs some things that I'm going to have to provide for him. But I got to say that I enjoyed our conversation a lot today, Bob. And it's good when we laugh.
We get to the itchiness of it all, the scratching
of the
itch. Okay, great talking to you, Cameron. We'll talk soon.
Same here, Bob. Look forward to the next time.
All right, great. Bye.
Yep. Bye.